Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Minority Speaker Hakeem Jeffries has been talking for almost 8 hours on the floor of the Capitol to highlight the cruelty of Donald Trump's bill, which was passed by Senate Republicans a few days ago. According to the New York Times, the bill would slash taxes for the wealthy by $4.5 trillion, increase funding for the military and the border, cut about $1 trillion from Medicaid, and reduce food assistance for the poor. The House is expected to vote on the bill today, and we will do a show on Tuesday. Today, we are discussing the abortion landscape across the country, 3 years after the 6 conservatives on the Supreme Court gave states the right to implement abortion bans. 41 states have bans in effect with only limited exceptions, according to the Guttmacher Institute. 13 states have a total abortion ban. These bans affect people of color and low-income people the most, according to studies. While most states had small changes in the number of abortions provided from 2023 to 2024, Florida's numbers decreased sharply after a 6-week ban went into effect in May 2024. Over the full calendar year, there were 11,200 fewer abortions provided in the state in 2024 compared to 2023. The Guttmacher Institute found that last year, 155,000 people traveled out of their state for abortion care. That represents 15% of all abortion patients. So much has changed since the fall of Roe. And I want to highlight just a few headlines because these headlines give you a sense of what has been happening. A brain-dead woman is being kept on machines to gestate a fetus. It was inevitable, the New York Times. Michigan GOP lawmaker introduces legislation to classify abortion as homicide, the Mission Advance. A striking trend. After Texas banned abortion, more women nearly bled to death during miscarriage, ProPublica. Texas capital murder case attempts to severely punish abortion pill use by treating a fetus as a person, the Texas Tribune. Abortion bans caused increase in intimate partner violence, according to a new study, Newsweek. Criminalizing pregnancy. A record number of women were prosecuted the year after Dobbs, Mother Jones. And Planned Parenthood must choose between abortion or millions in federal funding. Under the new spending bill, the nation's largest abortion provider would have to stop offering abortion in some states or lose millions in Medicaid funding for basic health care, New York Times. That's everything from breast cancer screenings to help with UTIs to so many other forms of basic health care. So joining us to talk about all of this are two guests. Dana Sussman is Senior Vice President for Pregnancy Justice, an organization that works to advance and defend the rights of pregnant people, no matter if they give birth, experience a pregnancy loss, or have an abortion. And Pregnancy Justice has been doing a lot of very important work on criminal cases. They found that in the first year after Dobbs, prosecutors initiated at least 210 cases charging pregnant people with crimes related to pregnancy, pregnancy loss, or birth. Hi, Dana. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Amy Littlefield is the nation's abortion access correspondent and author of the forthcoming book, American Crusaders, a history of the anti-abortion movement over the last 50 years. Hi, Amy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. It's great to be back with you.
Well, it's great to have you, Amy. I want to start off with you because you've been doing such important reporting over the years. And I have to say, Amy, when I was doing research for this show, I just kept finding these articles with these head-spinning headlines. And it really does let people know what has happened since the fall of Roe. I mean, everything from a Republican lawmaker wanting to classify abortion as a homicide to intimate partner violence increasing in states where abortion is illegal. I mean, so much has changed in the last 3 years.
So much has changed, and it really is dizzying to try to wrap your head around it. Although there is one other headline I want to add to the mix, Rose, and that's actually a hopeful one, dare I say, which is that after Dobbs, the number of abortions in this country actually increased when you look at the national picture. I'm looking at a recent article by Carol Jaffe and David Cohen, who have a book on this rise called After Dobbs that just came out. And they documented how providers, blue states like California, really rose to the challenge, how telemedicine abortion really got off the ground, how places mailing medication abortion really flourished in the year plus after Dobbs. And so we actually saw abortion access thriving in some unexpected ways as the number of abortions actually increased because it became more accessible through creative solutions like shield laws in blue states and through telemedicine abortion. So it's a dizzying picture because it is so uneven, right? We know that people have died. We know that ProPublica has documented that people have died preventable deaths because of abortion bans in states like Texas. And at the same time, we know that it is easier today to get an abortion in a state like Mississippi than it was before Dobbs, because there are doctors sitting in New York who will mail you abortion pills for very affordable prices through the mail, even into those red states. And so it's such a complex picture. You have to take into account the criminalization. You have to take into account all of the draconian efforts that, you know, conservatives have been advancing. And also how uneven it is just based on your zip code, which has always been the reality of abortion access, even before Dobbs.
Right. And your income and your overall, just where do you have access? I mean, that's the thing. When we did so many shows about travel, you know, people in the South said, wait a minute, we've got to talk about the fact that so many of our patients do not have the means to travel.
Right. Right. Absolutely.
Dana, what would you add when you look back at 3 years after Roe? What really stands out for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Amy highlights here is the rise of medication abortion and the normalization of medication abortion. And advocates have done a really fantastic job demystifying what that looks like, talking about it openly on social media. And I think medication abortion access is sort of the one thing that is preventing us from looking like a pre-Roe past of dozens and hundreds of women going to emergency rooms, being ill or dying because of unsafe abortion. So the access to medication abortion cannot be overemphasized in this post-Dobbs landscape. But from our perspective, the criminalization of pregnancy didn't start after the Dobbs decision. This has been happening since at least the 1980s in the United States. Women who are prosecuted for things like child abuse, child neglect, murder or manslaughter for conduct during pregnancy, for their pregnancy outcomes. And we are seeing an acceleration of this. We are seeing more prosecutions. We are seeing pregnancy loss increasingly seen as a suspect event, a criminally suspect event. But it's important to recognize that the United States has a decades-long history of prosecuting pregnant people for not being perfect pregnant people, not having a perfect birth outcome, having a substance use disorder and being pregnant. And as we look, you know, looming large is this bill that's about to be passed. And as we look at dismantling of healthcare even further and dismantling of access to prenatal care, to abortion care and everything else, we are facing a real cliff, even worse than we've seen before, of people not getting essential care that they need and further driving them into very vulnerable situations where they might not be able to access prenatal care that they want, or being forced to carry pregnancies that they don't want, and then sort of having this infrastructure or this specter of criminalization kind of looming on top of that puts people who are already in very vulnerable situations in even more precarious ones.
Well, I want to give out the phone number if you'd like to join us. If you have any questions for our guests about the abortion landscape 3 years after the Roe decision, if you've got any personal stories to share, if you have been working on these issues for many, many years, and you'd like to talk about just your overall thoughts, If you work with advocacy groups, what are you hearing from them? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. I'm also really curious if you have a child in school or if you're a teacher. I want to do a show about sex ed and how that has changed after Roe. But if you have any insights about what kind of sex ed is being taught at this time, we'd love to hear from you because these issues are all so connected. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Dana, how do you all at Pregnancy Justice follow and track prosecutions? Because I'm looking at your map right now. In Alabama, there were 104 cases. In Oklahoma, 68. Here in California, there was actually one case, which might surprise people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really, really hard thing to do. Our criminal legal system does not have a centralized database nationwide. We often have to go county by county, calling clerk's offices, looking at online dockets, sometimes even going to courthouses and printing out materials. And what is important to understand about pregnancy-related prosecutions is prosecutors are not using laws that have the word pregnancy or abortion in them. They are using laws of general application. So they're even harder to find because they're not, you know, we can't look at one particular statute for what a prosecutor might use. They're using general laws around child abuse or murder or manslaughter, sometimes, quote, abuse of a corpse. In the context of someone who might be having to deal with miscarriage remains or fetal remains. So we, when you point out Alabama, that's a state we've been working in for a very long time. And that state has a long history of prosecuting pregnant people. It's one of only three states in the country that has a state Supreme Court decision that says that embryos and fetuses are, quote, people under their criminal and civil laws. So what does that mean in the context of abortion rights? What does that mean in the context of IVF? And we saw just last year that the Alabama Supreme Court extended that to frozen embryos in the context of IVF and said that frozen embryos are, quote, embryonic children under that framework. So there is a long sort of history of this. We certainly see these trends accelerate, and Alabama has long been a place where pregnancy prosecutions are happening at exceedingly high rates. And the map that you described is even an undercount. We are still compiling data from that first year, and are working on year two at the moment to be able to paint a fuller picture of how legally precarious it is to be pregnant in the United States. And, you know, as you mentioned, this does not hit everyone equally. Even in a state like Alabama, certain counties are doing this far more than others. Mm-hmm. We're seeing this more in rural places, in poor counties, and women of color and poor white women are the people who are often most at risk for these kinds of charges.
And listeners who might not be familiar with this are probably wondering right now, what is the basis for these prosecutions? Why are these people being prosecuted? And I just want to read from a story by Lauren Sausser in KFF Health News. This was from September. It's called, "She was accused of murder after losing her pregnancy. South Carolina woman now tells her story." Amari Marsh just finished her junior year at South Carolina State University in May 2023 when she received a text message from a law enforcement officer. The officer wrote, "Sorry it's taken this long for paperwork to come back. I finally have the final report. Wanted to see if you and your boyfriend could meet me Wednesday afternoon for a follow-up." Marsh understood the report was related to her pregnancy loss she'd experienced that March. During her second trimester, she said she unexpectedly gave birth in the middle of the night while on a toilet in her off-campus apartment. She remembered screaming and panicking and said the bathroom was covered in blood. The next day, when she woke up in a hospital, she said a law enforcement officer asked her questions. A few weeks later, she received a call saying she could collect her daughter's ashes. Just stepping away from the piece, this is just a horrific story. And then going back to what Lauren Sousser writes, at that point, she said she did not know she was being criminally investigated. Yet 3 months after her loss, Marsh was charged with murder homicide by child abuse law enforcement records show. This August, 13 months after she was released from jail to house arrest with an ankle monitor, Marsh was cleared by a grand jury. Her case will not proceed to trial. I mean, this is incredible, Dana.
Yeah. And Amari's case is one that we worked on in partnership with many organizations, including advocates in South Carolina. And it just shows that pregnancy loss is so misunderstood by, you know, police, prosecutors, how common of an experience it is. And also your the most sort of vulnerable and, you know, in a medically traumatic situation, your reaction, your behavior, how quickly you call 911, how you've described your pregnancy to others in your life, all of those things become suspicious. And that is what has happened in Amari's case and in other cases surrounding pregnancy loss. Luckily, we have seen in this case and another case in Ohio, grand juries do not like these cases. Voters do not like these cases. And they have declined to indict women who have faced charges in connection with their pregnancy losses in multiple cases over the past couple of years. But when we are in a space in which your behavior around your pregnancy loss is up for investigation, we are in a very, very dangerous place. And I just want to name one more thing. In our research, those 210 cases we identified in that first year post-Dobbs, in five of them, what we refer to as abortion contemplation was used as evidence in support of the charges, meaning that someone might have searched for abortion online, might have talked to people about not wanting to be pregnant. That information was then in the police report or in the charging document to justify charges against them. Now, they weren't explicitly abortion-related charges, but evidence of abortion contemplation is now becoming part of these criminal investigations.
And Amy, Amari Marsh's story just says so much about what so many people are going through. Everybody has a story. According to KFF, when Amari took an at-home pregnancy test in November 2022, the positive results scared her. She was in college at the time. She said, "I didn't know what to do. I didn't want to let my parents down. I was in a state of shock." She did not seek prenatal care, she said, because she kept having her period. She thought the pregnancy test might have been wrong.
I mean, it just speaks to how lack of information and the stigma around pregnancy and abortion and being able to talk about it and seek help. I mean, that is another huge compounding factor we're talking about here, in addition to whether someone has money, in addition to their race and how they're treated by the medical system to begin with, right? This is someone who was scared to even find out the information about what her options might be, which is another huge barrier, right? We know that medication abortion is out there, but your ability to access it depends not only on your calculations around whether you might or someone you love might be criminalized if you seek it out, if you're in a restrictive state. It also depends on whether you know that the information is out there and whether you have the resources to be able to find accurate information in a world where misinformation is swirling. You know, and I think Dana brings up another crucial point, which is a lot of the strategies, the anti-abortion strategies that your headlines that you read at the top reflect, are not new, right? These are strategies that the anti-abortion movement has floated before the Dobbs decision, but that are, you know, receiving far more attention and have far more traction now that the constitutional right to abortion is gone. And personhood, right, the idea that the fetus or the embryo is a person from the moment of conception, this has always been the anti-abortion movement's holy grail. This has always been the goal. It's never been about, you know, restricting abortion at 20 weeks or restricting it, you know, so that minors can't get it without parental permission. Those have always been incremental restrictions on the way towards full personhood for embryos and fetuses. And I think many of the dystopian headlines that we're seeing now are a result of this paradigm really spreading, right? I mean, you mentioned this tragic case of the woman who was kept alive, you know, or kept, you know, on ventilation, even though she was brain dead, Adriana Smith, in order to, you know, continue gestating her fetus. And that really is a result of the logic of personhood, right? Of treating the embryo or the fetus as an equal or even more important human than the person who is carrying it. I think we're also seeing that in this criminal case out of Texas, right? Where you have this man, horrible, tragic situation where a man in North Texas was charged with capital murder for slipping his girlfriend an abortion-inducing medication. Reportedly, the first time a murder charge has been brought in an abortion-related case in Texas. It's obviously a terrible situation. No one would ever defend what this man has done or allegedly done. And yet the agenda that's at issue here is not at all new and not at all, you know, confined to post-Dobbs. It's just that it's more possible now, right? This is about establishing that embryo or fetus had full personhood and that this was an attack not on a woman, right? I mean, this is obviously the person who was mistreated here was the pregnant person who wanted to continue her pregnancy. And yet the paradigm is shifting here where this is becoming about a crime against, you know, the fetus or embryo as a person. And I think that's the underlying paradigm we see in a lot of these cases that Dana and her team have highlighted.
Yeah, this is an incredible story. I was reading about this Straight Arrow News. This is a new website I just stumbled upon. They basically, it's a legitimate site. They just say that they're straight right down the middle. So just to let people know where this information's coming from. So they report that the man in this case learned that his then girlfriend was pregnant. She wanted to keep the baby. He did not and offered to pay for an abortion. The following month, he allegedly met her at a coffee shop and secretly added mifepristone to her coffee and cookies. The next day, she reported a miscarriage. Joanna Grossman, a law professor at Southern Methodist University, told the Texas Tribune the case has serious legal implications. Quote, it has implications for all kinds of fertility medicine, and it has potential implications for criminal and immigration law. If you detain a pregnant woman, are you illegally detaining the fetus who did not commit a crime? The purpose of this has nothing to do with caring whether this woman was victimized, but it's about trying to establish fetal personhood. That speaks to what you just laid out there, Amy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, cases like this are tragic and horrible. And, you know, you talked also about the tie-in between domestic violence and abortion restrictions, right? I mean, clearly, you know, these are not cases that, you know, that we ever want to happen. I think, unfortunately, the anti-abortion movement loves stories like this because it makes it seem like every woman out there who has an abortion is being coerced, right? Which is definitely not the case. And I think it also speaks to a real rhetorical problem that the anti-abortion movement has in this moment, which is that somewhere around 2/3 of abortions in this country right now are being accomplished through medication, which means that you have very minimal involvement from a healthcare practitioner. You have a person who is taking pills in their own home, typically of their own volition. And it is very hard for the anti-abortion movement to say that every single person who goes through that process is a victim, right? I mean, certainly in a case like this, if the facts turn out to be true, I mean, that is a case of clear coercion, right? And yet in the vast majority of cases, that is not what is happening. And so how do you, if your goal is to end abortion in all cases, how do you do that without criminalizing the pregnant person when 2/3 of abortions are being accomplished by someone taking pills in the comfort of their own home? It can't happen. And so I think that's why we're seeing this creeping increase in criminalization of pregnant people, and why we're seeing some, you know, lawmakers in some states saying the quiet part out loud and saying, hey, abortion is murder. And that means people who have abortions are murderers, and let's treat them as such. You know, the abortion abolition movement, that's the driving force behind a lot of these efforts. They're only growing in terms of their influence. And I think that's really a case of people saying, again, saying the quiet part out loud. loud saying what the goal really is here. And those numbers are reflected in Dana and her team's reports.
Dana, what would you like to add?
The case in Texas is exactly as Amy described. It's the perfect fodder. It's the perfect case for the anti-abortion movement to normalize and entrench fetal personhood in law and in cases. As Amy described, this person is facing capital murder, which, to our knowledge, this is the first time that this is being used in such a circumstance. And the existence of the harm done to his ex-partner is erased from this story, right? The victim here is a 6-week-old embryo. No charges have been brought for the harm caused to the formerly pregnant person, to her body, to her life. That's been completely erased from this story. And I just want to point out too, to pick up where Amy left off, we tracked 15 different bills across 15 states this legislative session that's now coming to a close, that would redefine abortion as homicide for the purpose of charging the pregnant person with homicide. All the abortion bans that we've seen so far focus on providing abortion care. So that's prohibited, that's banned, and healthcare providers can't provide. But this shift in focus now to, we are going to name it as homicide in the criminal code and charge, which would allow us to charge pregnant women seeking abortions with homicide. And many of those same states would, this would pull in the death penalty. These would be death penalty eligible crimes. Mm. None of these bills passed. Most of them didn't move out of committee, but it is shocking, even as someone who's been working in this field for a while, it is shocking that 15 bills of this kind were introduced. We would see one or two in the first years after Dobbs, but it really exploded this year. Because as Amy said, the end game, the holy grail, is full personhood for embryos and fetuses. And to get to that logical end, all abortions are murder, and all people who obtain them are murderers, and therefore they should be criminally charged as such. And so that is that was deeply concerning for us. We shouldn't be complacent that none of those bills moved very far this session, because it's shifting the Overton window, and it is making it feel more and more normal that this is the kind of thing we should come to expect.
Right. I mean, just to add to that briefly, the Texas Tribune report on this story, John Sego, president of Texas Right to Life, told the reporter that he believes prosecutors are approaching the case this way because it's easier to prove that the suspect, the man, the boyfriend in this case, committed a capital murder than it is to prove that he harmed the pregnant woman. I mean, that makes me want to walk outside my front door and scream, right? Like, what reality are we living in where it's easier in this legal landscape, theoretically, to prove for the first time ever that pregnancy termination is a capital murder than it is to prove that someone harmed their partner by imposing, you know, an abortion on them without their consent. I mean, I can't. It's, again, another instance of saying the quiet part out loud of exactly the misogynist and dystopian legal environment we're dealing with here.
We're going to take a quick break. That is Amy Littlefield, the nation's abortion access correspondent and author of the forthcoming book, American Crusaders, A History of the Anti-Abortion Movement Over the Last 50 Years. Dana Sussman is Senior Vice President for Pregnancy Justice. They work to advance and defend the rights of pregnant people, no matter if they give birth, experience a pregnancy loss, or have an abortion. Today, we're talking about the abortion landscape 3 years after Supreme Court conservatives gave states the right to implement abortion bans. 41 states have bans in effect with only limited exceptions, and 13 states have total bans, according to the Guttmacher Institute. If you have any questions or comments, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you are in the Bay Area, we hope you can join us for a special live Your Call show to focus again on the caregiving crisis in this country. It'll be Wednesday, July 9th, 5 p.m., a number of really incredible caregiving organizations will be there to talk about their services. And then we'll have our live discussion at 6 p.m. California State Assemblymember Matt Haney will be on the panel. It's Wednesday, July 9th, 5 p.m. at the San Francisco Public Library, the main library, 100 Larkin Street. Find more information at kalw.org. Today, we are talking about the abortion landscape in the U.S. 3 years after Supreme Court conservatives gave states the right to implement abortion bans. Today, we're joined by Dana Sussman, Senior Vice President for Pregnancy Justice, an organization that works to advance and defend the rights of pregnant people, no matter if they give birth, experience a pregnancy loss, or have an abortion. Amy Littlefield is the nation's abortion access correspondent and author of the forthcoming book, American Crusaders, A History of the Anti-Abortion Movement Over the Last 50 Years. Pulling back for a minute, Amy, every time you're on the show, we often talk about the fact that the media has spent years, mainstream media across the board, has spent years saying that abortion is one of the most divisive issues of our time. Even though 60, 70%, depending on the poll of the population, supports keeping abortion legal. And so you and I have talked about that a lot. And I just wonder, looking back and looking back at just the decades-long fight to overturn Roe, and now that we're here, to go so far to want people to be prosecuted for murder. I mean, you're working on a book about this very topic. When you look back to think about how we got to this place, what really stands out for you?
I mean, I think what really stands out is how intertwined the struggle for democracy in this moment is with the struggle for abortion rights, precisely because of what you just pointed out, right? Abortion rights are popular. They've been popular for a long time. They're more popular than most politicians, right? We know, I mean, in just that case you highlight in Michigan, right, where this draconian bill to declare abortion to be homicide has been floated in the state. I mean, this is a state where 57% of Michigan voters in 2022 approved adding the right to abortion to the state constitution, right? So clearly these draconian efforts are outliers in terms of public opinion and democracy. The reproductive justice activist Renee Bracey Sherman has a line that I love, which is abortion is not a divisive issue. It's a gerrymandered issue, right? It's an issue in a lot of states like Ohio, right, where we've seen anti-abortion policies advance because of Republican gerrymandering of state legislatures, and where, unfortunately, progressive neglect of state legislatures in purple and red states has allowed that sort of anti-democratic behavior to happen. And so I think when we look at how we got here, right, we're talking about state legislatures, many of which have been gerrymandered. We're talking about the Supreme Court, which I think, as you pointed out, you know, a lot of the conservative appointees were appointed by presidents who did not win the popular vote, right? This is what it takes to advance an anti-abortion agenda. And so as we watch, you know, our democracy being dismantled before our eyes on multiple fronts, I think we have to understand the extent to which abortion rights were really the canary in the coal mine. I mean, I'm thinking about it now with this so-called big, beautiful bill, right? Up to 12 million people about to potentially lose their Medicaid. And I think about the fact, which is kind of the through line in my book, about how the first major anti-abortion victory was taking away federal funding of abortion and cutting off most Medicaid coverage of abortion in 1976, right? It was one of the first major victories after Roe v. Wade. And it's taken them decades, but that effort, which was really not just about abortion, but also about attacking the poor and taking away the social safety net, we're seeing the culmination of that now.
And to add to that, Amy, we're going to do a show about this bill on Tuesday, and researchers at the University of Pennsylvania, Harvard, and Yale found that 51,000 people will die every year because of these Medicaid cuts. I mean, you have to read this twice. Historic coverage loss could cause over 51,000 people to lose their lives every year. I mean, this is really, this is dark stuff we're talking about.
It's really dark. It's really dark. And you know, Planned Parenthood has warned up to 200 health centers are at risk of closure, right? Because they could lose hundreds of millions of dollars in federal funding. And this is one of our main safety health net healthcare providers, you know, not just for abortion care, but for a whole range of life-saving services. So it's dark.
Dana, again, it's one thing to debate these issues, but the system is designed to be so undemocratic. I mean, we've talked so many times on this show about the fact that what people want, politicians, mostly Republicans, that's just a fact, tend to do the opposite. So how do you fight this, given that you've got presidents who did not win the popular vote appointing these, you know, lifelong Supreme Court justices? Amy pointed out the gerrymandering, massive voter suppression. It's such an undemocratic system. So given that, how do you stand up against that?
I mean, in some days and in some fights, it seems impossible. I think the thing that we work in really conservative places. We litigate cases in Alabama and Oklahoma, but also in less conservative places like Michigan and Pennsylvania. And one of the things that, you know, on the criminal defense side, you know, there's been lots of discussion of criminal justice reform over the past several years. The system is so stacked against defendants in all sorts of ways, not just in our cases. But when we actually show up and provide a robust defense, we often win our cases. Mm-hmm. And so it's about resources, and it's about similar to the discussion about this budget bill. It is really, what is driving this is disdain for poor people, disdain for people of color. And I think one thing we haven't really spoken about yet today is just disdain for women. And we know we use gender expansive language when we talk about pregnant people, but most people who become pregnant are women, and this is about erasure of women from the public sphere. We've talked so much about, you know, Project 2025 and the ambitions there and the cuts to certain programs and the ways in which women are being forced into a place back into the domestic sphere where our greatest contribution is to birth as many babies as possible. And we have to talk about it in these terms because this is all part of an authoritarian playbook to impose harmful gender stereotypes. I mean, we're seeing the dismantling of 14th Amendment protections in the Scrimeti case, the Supreme Court decision a couple weeks ago surrounding gender-affirming care. We are seeing this train going down the tracks around 14th Amendment, really not protecting anyone but essentially white Christians and fetuses. And, you know, we have to really call it out and really do our job as advocates and as people who write about this and as people who speak about this, about what is actually happening, and name it and not worry about politesse at this point. It is too late. It is too dangerous. It is too scary. We have a maternal health crisis in this country already. Black women are dying at horrific rates in childbirth. And the fact that tens of thousands of more people are going to die because of the cruelty of this bill, and it will disproportionately, overwhelmingly impact those people who are already so vulnerable. To just provide tax cuts to the wealthiest of us. I mean, I don't know how more plainly we can talk about it, in that this is really all of a project to ensure that sort of white Christian men hold on to power. And it's at the sort of to the detriment, to the harm of everyone else.
I'm glad you brought this up, Dana, because I'm often afraid that girls get lost in these conversations. Mm-hmm. And I remember when the 10-year-old child victim of rape in Ohio had to cross state lines for an abortion. I mean, 10 years old. And I saw a lot of people asking, how can a 10-year-old get pregnant? Which just speaks to the lack of education about these issues. I wonder what your thoughts are about where we are with girls and pregnancy and the overturning of Roe in 2022, the New York Times reported that the number of pregnancies in the U.S. among girls under the age of 15 fell sharply in recent decades, with greater access to contraception and a drop in adolescent sexual activity. But state and federal data suggest there are still thousands of such cases every year. Nearly half of these pregnancies end in abortion. Do you know, Dana, do we have much research yet on how the overturning of Roe is affecting girls?
I haven't seen that, but I have seen reports about mental health, the mental health impacts of the overturning of Roe. And I remember reading a piece speaking to teenage girls after, I think it might have been after the election or it was after the Dobbs decision, and how upset so many young women were because they woke up the next morning knowing that their rights and their bodies would not be the same. And that sort of their young male friends and classmates had not a care in the world, right? And so I often think about, in addition to sort of the mental health impact on this, about where young women, if they have the ability, where they're choosing to go to college, you know, how they enter into relationships with young men. We're seeing a hugely stark divide in sort of the politics of young people and the ways in which young women are voting for Democrats and young men are voting for Republicans. And now there's some new data showing that there's an even greater gender divide among people who are support abortion rights and those who don't. We are living in a world in which, you know, our daughters, my daughter, will have fewer rights than I enjoyed during the years in which I could become pregnant. And so I worry greatly about young girls, about young women, and the world in which they're entering, where not only are they living in a moment where if they get pregnant, they might have to navigate so many considerations about their privacy, about their legal risk, about their health risk, but they also might not have an opportunity to really have healthy relationships because the ways in which women and our place in society is being viewed and the
Oh, are you still there, Dana? I think we lost Dana. Amy, are you still with us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. You're back.
Oh, sorry. I was just saying that I think that the ways in which young women are going to have to navigate relationships in this new world in which their own bodily autonomy is undermined is really scary. And I think I'm not sure that we've been preparing ourselves for how we prepare our daughters for that world.
Mm. Yeah. Amy, what would you like to add?
Yeah, I think I think Dana said that so well. I think what I would add to that is that part of the anti-abortion movement's incremental strategy over the years has been going after restrictions that they think sound benevolent, sound like they might have, you know, curry favor even among people who are pro-choice. And that's why we saw parental consent laws, right? And parental notification laws that restrict access to minors unless they have a parent involved. We saw those proliferate so that they had passed in a majority of states even before the Dobbs decision, right? And I think that was part of a really smart incremental strategy by the anti-abortion movement to say, huh, we think parents are going to be sympathetic to arguments around parents' rights. Who doesn't want to think that their 16-year-old daughter is going to come to them, you know? And what they don't realize is what happens when you have somebody who's a victim of abuse, or somebody who has been a victim of incest and is afraid to tell her parents, or somebody who, for whatever reason, you know, can't get that parental consent. And so I think, you know, we're seeing that rear its head again, as Dana pointed out, with this, the playbook, the anti-Roe playbook is really now being trained on transgender people. And, you know, the fact that Roe, which was the anti-abortion movement, the conservative movement's devil for many years, is now gone. They've needed to sort of retrain their energy. and they're going after transgender people and especially trans kids. And we're seeing that same exact logic that damaged healthcare access for minors in terms of abortion now being used to go after trans children who need access to gender affirming care that can be just as life saving. And so I think we need to recognize the patterns here, right? Like, I can remember being at the Family Research Council's conference in the wake of the Dobbs decision and seeing them retraining this playbook, this rhetoric of parental rights, and, you know, that this, these terms that they had used successfully around abortion for years, and retraining it, rejiggering them so it could be used to go after trans people. I think it's so clear that it's the same groups behind that strategy. And it's so horrifying to me that young people are facing the full, you know, are becoming the target of this administration's, you know, policies.
Well, and then to talk about subjects that deserve far more attention, we don't talk about enough. And just to let listeners know, we'll talk about rape and partner violence here because these issues are just so incredibly important. NPR had an important piece last January about an abortion provider in Montana, Dr. Samuel Dickman, who had seen patients routinely telling him they became pregnant after a rape. And he just wondered, you know, how many people are raped and then become pregnant. He really wanted to find out. So he and his colleagues did some research. They estimate in a research letter published in JAMA that over 64,000 pregnancies have been caused by rape in the 14 states where abortion is banned. And then to talk about partner violence, research came out from the National Bureau of Economic Research, and it found a direct link between restricted abortion access and a rise in conflict and abuse within relationships. It found the most significant percentage increases were reported among teenagers and women aged 40 to 44. Dana, these issues just deserve so much more attention. And I mean, when you think about, you know, let's say there's a couple living in a state in the South where abortion is illegal, Florida, Texas, you name the state, and let's say it's a man and a woman, and the man knows that if his partner gets pregnant, she doesn't have options. Mm-hmm. And I think we just need to talk about this more, because I think about these women suffering in silence.
It's really, I sometimes am at a loss of words of really how to describe just how horrific these situations are. I think there is a direct connection between sort of the state, the government, our officials dehumanizing women in such a way with laws that are being passed with restrictions on abortion, and the way that that gives permission for partners and people in their lives to dehumanize them as well. It's state violence and it's intimate partner violence. And it sort of just multiplies the harm. I'm also thinking about reports out of Texas in which I think it was the Attorney General of Texas has sought to bring men in to report on their partners who are getting abortions, who are getting abortion pills mailed to them in Texas. So not only are we creating an environment, sort of the perfect storm to allow intimate partner violence to flourish and to force women to stay trapped in dangerous relationships, but we are also encouraging men to report on their partners, on their wives, to use the threat of state violence, right, of arrest or prosecution or investigation against them. And you can just imagine how dangerous that is. We, even before Dobbs, being pregnant was an incredibly dangerous situation, a huge risk factor for women who were in violent situations. Violence got worse during pregnancy, or it often starts during pregnancy. And now we're in a place where that pregnancy and any sort of, you know, and if you want to try and get out of that relationship, or you don't want to be pregnant, that can be used against you. So it is this really tangled, dangerous web that has been built around this. And again, I just have to go back to sort of the dehumanizing nature of this for women, the idea that they are being forced sort of even more and more sort of into these isolating situations within the domestic sphere, and that they are not given any way to get out.
Amy, we have a few people writing in saying, thank you for your work. One person says, I have no idea what to add to this conversation. I don't even know what we can do at this point. In our remaining minute, Amy, what are you hearing from advocates?
I mean, I think there's a tentative sense of hope right now because of the success of telemedicine abortion. You know, I talked to a doctor who runs a service called The Map that is based in blue states, and they mail abortion medication to red states. And she told me, look, we can send a medication abortion pill packet to someone in Mississippi today for $5. That was not possible before the Dobbs decision, right? When you had one clinic in the state and you had a whole host of requirements that made it, you know, next to impossible or as hard as possible for patients to reach that clinic and to actually get their appointment. So I think there's a tentative hope. I think the big question is we don't know exactly what the Trump administration is going to do or what the Supreme Court is going to do when it comes to medication abortion and telehealth access to medication abortion. But just to end on a hopeful note, I think what advocates and providers have shown in the 3 years since the Dobbs decision is just how adaptable they are to crisis. And it's taken a little bit of time, but we are now in a situation where people, if they go to plancypills.org, if they live in a state where abortion is restricted, or you can go to Abortion Finder or I Need an A, these are places where people everywhere in the country can find access to safe abortion services, because providers and abortion funders and people all across this ecosystem have really risen to the challenge in a way that I think, you know, we didn't see that energy and that momentum or that funding, you know, coming from that collective outrage before the Dobbs decision. And so that's really, if there is a silver lining, you know, I think that's what it is.
Well, we will definitely do a show about that. Amy Littlefield is the nation's abortion access correspondent and author of the forthcoming book, American Crusaders. It's a history of the anti-abortion movement over the last 50 years. Dana Sussman is senior vice president for pregnancy justice. They work to advance and defend the rights of pregnant people. Amy and Dana, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Rose.
Thank you. And I should say the New York Times reported that about 15 minutes ago, Minority Speaker Hakeem Jeffries just yielded after 8 hours and 45 minutes. It's a record-breaking speech. The House is now going to vote on Trump's bill, and we will do a show on Tuesday. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.